All right, welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're diving into a really interesting area where tribal sovereignty and federal law kind of clash.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area.
So imagine this. You've got a coal company. They're operating on Navajo land.
Okay.
And their lease says they should prioritize hiring Navajo people. Makes sense, right? They're on Navajo land.
Seems reasonable.
But then you've got federal anti-discrimination law, specifically Title VII. And Title VII says, hold on, you can't discriminate based on national origin.
Right.
So that's the central question we're tackling. Can a company, even when operating on tribal land with this kind of lease, give preference to tribal members without running afoul of federal law?
It's a tricky one for sure. It gets at the heart of how tribal self-governance and federal efforts to prevent discrimination sometimes have to coexist.
And the case we're using to explore this is EEOC v. Peabody Western Coal Company. This went up to the Ninth Circuit back in 2010. And it's a great example of this tension between these two really important legal principles. So to really dissect this, we've got the court documents themselves, plus some expert legal analysis to help us break it all down.
Great.
Our goal today is to walk you through this complex legal landscape. We want you to understand what the core legal arguments were, how the court reasoned through it all, and what it means for the bigger picture of how tribal rights and federal employment law work together.
Absolutely. It can seem pretty dense at first glance, but hopefully we can shed some light on it.
Okay, so first things first. Peabody wasn't just mining coal anywhere. This was specifically on Navajo Nation land.
Right. That's super important. They were operating these coal mines on Navajo land. And the key detail here is that they were doing so under leases that were approved by the U.S. Department of the Interior. So essentially, the federal government had signed off on the terms under which Peabody could operate these mines.
So the federal government's involved from the get-go.
Absolutely. And one of the crucial conditions in those leases was that Peabody had to give a hiring preference to members of the Navajo Nation. This wasn't just a suggestion. It was a requirement written right into the agreement.
Interesting. So you've got this federally approved lease with this hiring preference built in, and then the EEOC enters the picture. What was their concern?
Well, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, or EEOC, they filed a lawsuit against Peabody. And their argument was pretty straightforward. They said that by favoring Navajo applicants over non-Navajo applicants based on tribal membership, Peabody was engaging in discrimination based on national origin. And that, they argued, violates Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Basically, they saw this preference as unfairly disadvantaging people who weren't members of the Navajo Nation.
Seems like a pretty clear-cut case for discrimination, right? You'd think it would go straight to trial. But you mentioned there was some procedural back and forth before that could happen. What went on?
Yeah, it wasn't a simple path. The district court actually dismissed the EEOC's lawsuit twice. And both times, the reason was this thing called Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 19.
Rule 19.
Yeah. Basically, the court was saying, we can't really make a fair and binding decision here unless we have all the necessary parties involved.
So Rule 19, necessary parties. I think for a lot of people that might sound like legalese. What does that actually mean in simple terms?
Sure. So Rule 19A lays out the concept of necessary parties. And essentially it boils down to this. If the court can't fully resolve the legal issues in a case without a certain party being present, or if a party who's not there has a really strong interest in the outcome and their absence could hurt their rights, then that absent party is considered necessary. They need to be brought into the case. It's all about fairness and making sure everyone who has a stake in the outcome can have their voice heard and protect their interests.
So in the Peabody case, who were the missing players and why did the court initially consider them so crucial to have at the table?
The district court was mainly concerned about two key players, the Navajo Nation itself and the Secretary of the Interior. Now, the Navajo Nation clearly had a big stake in this. After all, the hiring preference was specifically designed to benefit their members, and it was the condition that they had negotiated with Peabody as part of those leases. So ruling against Peabody's hiring practice could potentially undermine that agreement and their interests. But there was a twist. The Ninth Circuit, when they looked at this, they said that the Navajo Nation joining the case was actually feasible because they had the option to waive their sovereign immunity.
Sovereign immunity.
Right. Sovereign immunity basically means they're protected from lawsuits. But they can choose to waive that protection and voluntarily participate in a lawsuit. And that's what they ended up doing.
Interesting. So their willingness to participate made them, in a sense, less necessary in the strictest legal definition.
Exactly. They stepped up and said, we want to be a part of this. So that addressed one concern.
Okay. And what about the Secretary of the Interior? Why was the court saying they were a necessary party?
Well, the Secretary's involvement stems directly from those leases. Remember, the Department of the Interior was the one who approved them in the first place, acting under federal law. So the whole question of whether this hiring preference was legal or not really hinged on a decision made by the federal government. If the court decided against Peabody, it could potentially be seen as questioning the validity of those federally approved leases. And that's a big deal.
I see. So it's kind of like a chain reaction. The secretary approves the lease has this preference, and now the legality of the whole thing is in question.
Precisely.
And you mentioned the district court had trouble getting these necessary parties, particularly the secretary, involved.
Hmm.
What was the main obstacle?
The biggest hurdle was this thing called sovereign immunity. It's basically a legal principle that protects the federal government from being sued for damages unless it specifically consents to be sued.
This is like a shield.
Yeah, like a legal, you can't touch this shield. And in this case, because of sovereign immunity, the EEOC couldn't just sue the Secretary of the Interior directly for money.
Okay, so sovereign immunity blocks that route. But the Ninth Circuit, they didn't just give up. They found a kind of workaround, right?
They did. They suggested a clever legal maneuver using Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 14.
Rule 14, and what does that one do?
Rule 14 is all about bringing in a third party who might be liable for all or part of the claim. It's kind of like saying, hey, if I'm on the hook for this, this other party might be responsible too.
So how did that apply to the Peabody case? How did Rule 14 offer a way forward?
The Ninth Circuit said that Peabody could use Rule 14 to bring the Secretary of the Interior into the case, but not as the main defendant. They would be brought in as what's called a third-party defendant. And here's where it gets interesting. While sovereign immunity would still protect the Secretary from being directly sued for money by the EEOC, and would also protect Peabody from having to reimburse the Secretary if Peabody lost and had to pay damages, it didn't necessarily prevent the EEOC from seeking a different kind of remedy, something called injunctive relief.
Injunctive relief. So what is that?
Injunctive relief basically means asking the court to order someone to do something or to stop doing something in the future.
So in this case, it would be like telling the secretary to either uphold or strike down the lease provision going forward.
You got it. And that's where this really important legal doctrine comes in, called Ex Parte Young.
Ex Parte Young. Now, I'm guessing that rings a bell for some law students out there, but for those who haven't encountered it yet, can you break that down? What is that doctrine all about?
Sure. Imagine you have a situation where a police officer is doing something illegal. Ex parte Young basically says that you can sue that individual officer to stop them from continuing that illegal action, even if you can't sue the entire police department for money damages because of sovereign immunity. It's the same idea here with government officials. The idea is that if a government official is acting unconstitutionally, they're sort of stepping outside their official role, and so they lose that immunity shield for that specific action.
That makes sense. So Peabody could potentially use Rule 14 to bring the secretary in, not to demand money, but to argue about the future of that lease provision. And because they're asking for this future-focused injunction, sovereign immunity wouldn't necessarily block it.
Exactly. That was the Ninth Circuit's reasoning. Mm-hmm. By allowing Peabody to bring in the secretary under Rule 14 for this type of injunctive relief, the court could still address the core legal issue, the validity of that hiring preference in the leases, even with the limitations imposed by sovereign immunity.
Wow, that's a really interesting use of procedural rules to get around a seemingly insurmountable obstacle.
It is.
Okay, but let's move past the procedural stuff and get to the heart of the EEOC's claim. They said this hiring preference was national origin discrimination, pure and simple. Did the court agree? Did they see favoring Navajo workers as illegal discrimination?
This is where the court made a really crucial distinction. They emphasized that this hiring preference wasn't just about someone's ethnicity. It was specifically tied to being a member of the Navajo Nation. And that membership, they said, is connected to this unique political relationship between the Navajo Nation and the federal government. It's not just about where your ancestors are from. It's about belonging to a sovereign nation within a nation. And that relationship is rooted in treaties, federal laws, and this long-standing policy of the U.S. government to support tribal self-governance.
So it's that tribal membership that's the key here.
Absolutely. The court looked at a whole history of legal cases dealing with these issues. And those cases consistently treat membership in a federally recognized Indian tribe as a political classification, not a racial or national origin classification in the way we usually think of it under Title VII. It's more akin to citizenship in a sovereign entity that the U.S. government recognizes.
So the Navajo Nation has its own government, its own membership rules, and the U.S. government recognizes that political status. Okay, so it's not just about being ethnically Navajo. It's about being a recognized member of this political entity, the Navajo Nation.
Exactly. And this distinction has big implications for how we understand Title VII. The court said it essentially creates an exception to this broad rule against national origin discrimination, specifically when it comes to federally recognized tribes and their members, especially in situations where these hiring preferences are tied to the government's trust responsibilities to these tribes and are part of federally approved agreements like these mining leases.
Really fascinating. So based on all this procedural wrangling and this crucial distinction the court made, what was the Ninth Circuit's final decision in the Peabody Coal case?
Well, on the procedural side, the Ninth Circuit said the district court got it wrong when they completely dismissed the EEOC's request for an injunction for that future-focused relief. They said that part of the case could move forward, but they had to bring in the Secretary of the Interior as a third party using Rule 14. Now, they did uphold the dismissal of the EEOC's claim for monetary damages against Peabody, and that was because of the whole sovereign immunity issue with the secretary. You can't get money from someone who's immune.
Makes sense. And the big question, did they ultimately say whether the hiring preference itself was legal or not?
Well, at this stage of the case, they essentially sided with Peabody. They concluded that in this specific context where you have a hiring preference that's embedded in a federally approved lease on tribal land, this preference for Navajo Nation members was more of a political preference. It was tied to tribal sovereignty and the federal government's unique relationship with tribes, and not just about national origin in the usual sense. So they didn't see it as violating Title VII. But it's important to note that they sent the case back down to the lower court to continue, now with the Secretary of the Interior involved and with these guiding principles in mind. So it wasn't a complete victory for Peabody, but it was a significant step in their favor.
So zooming out a bit, what are the broader takeaways from this case? What does it tell us about how these different areas of law intersect?
This case is a great illustration of the kind of legal balancing act that often has to happen when you're dealing with tribal sovereignty and federal law. On the one hand, you have these federal laws against discrimination, which are incredibly important. But on the other hand, you have this long-standing commitment from the federal government to support tribal self-determination and economic development. And sometimes those goals can seem to be in tension. But this case shows that courts are willing to recognize the unique nature of tribal membership and to view hiring preferences like this one, preferences that are rooted in that government-to-government relationship and are part of federally approved agreements differently from other types of preferences based on someone's national origin.
And for our law student listeners, what are the key legal concepts to take away from this? What should they really pay attention to?
This case is a goldmine for understanding some really important legal principles. First, it highlights the crucial role of the federal rules of civil procedure, specifically Rule 19, which deals with who needs to be involved in a lawsuit, and Rule 14, which allows parties to bring in third parties who might be liable. These rules can literally make or break a case. Second, it really underscores the complexities of sovereign immunity, the principle that protects the government from lawsuits, and how it can limit what legal remedies are available. But it also shows how there can be exceptions, like the Ex parte Young Doctrine, which allows lawsuits to stop government officials from acting unlawfully. And finally, it provides a great example of how courts analyze discrimination claims when they involve federally recognized Indian tribes. The emphasis on the political nature of tribal membership, rather than just treating it as equivalent to race or national origin under Title VII, is a key takeaway.
Absolutely. All right, so for everyone listening, let's recap the key points. The Secretary of the Interior was a crucial party in this case, but could only be brought in to address future actions, not past monetary damages. And that was all because of sovereign immunity. Sovereign immunity also limited what the EEOC could ask for in the first place. And the court's big takeaway was that this hiring preference for Navajo tribal members, in the specific context of a federally approved lease on tribal land, wasn't viewed as illegal discrimination based on national origin under Title VII. Instead, they saw it as a political preference in tribal sovereignty.
It's a lot to unpack, but hopefully this gives everyone a better sense of how these issues play out in the real world. And it raises some important questions to ponder, like, how do we best balance the need to prevent discrimination with the recognition of tribal sovereignty and the special relationship between the federal government and Native American tribes? What are the long-term effects of treating tribal membership as a political classification distinct from national origin in different legal contexts? These are questions that legal scholars and policymakers continue to grapple with, and they're definitely worth thinking about as you continue your journey in the legal world.
Couldn't have said it better myself. Thanks for joining us on the Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for having me.